Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Hey there, Brent Smitley here from the Thirst for More podcast. And today's topic is something I'm really excited to talk about. And it's going to combine a bit of neuroscience and biomechanics and practical coaching in a way that once you get it, you're not going to be able to unsee it. And I'm talking specifically about plyometrics here today. And more specifically and importantly, why most plyometric training doesn't transfer to sport performance and exactly what you need to do differently. So what we're going to cover today is we're going to define reactive strength and explain why it's fundamentally different from explosive strengths. We're going to break down some definitions, why that distinction is important, and then we're going to break down the stretch shortening cycle that way that you can really understand what's going on from that perspective and how you can best use that whenever it comes to writing training programs or implementing it into your own training. And we're also going to talk about the Reactive Strength Index, or RSI, as a practical monitoring tool if you're able to do so. And then we're also going to identify the most common programming mistakes that I happen to see when it involves plyometric-based training. And I'm going to give you some specificity spectrum model that will change how you select exercises as well when it comes to your plyometrics. So we'll cover the periodization of plyometrics inside of a training block. We'll look at, break that all down, and then we'll finish with some sport-specific case study ideas here. So it's a pretty big, meaty, juicy episode. I really hope you like it. After doing a lot of research on this, I think this is something that a lot of coaches will really benefit from and enjoy. So let's start with the definition side of things here, because I think language is where a lot of people get mistakes happen and get some confusion. And most coaches use the word explosive as a catch-all for what they're trying to develop in their athletes. But explosive is actually a pretty vague term when they think about it. When I say my athlete is explosive, I might mean they can produce a lot of force from a standing position. I might mean that they can accelerate quickly. I might mean that they can jump incredibly high. Those are all different things, and they do not necessarily correlate with each other as much as we might like to think. The distinction I want you to really internalize today is this one thing here. Explosive strength is the ability to generate high force output from a relatively static or slow starting position. So think a squat jump from the bottom, a max effort power clean, for example, or a vertical jump with a prolonged counter movement. There's time available for the force production to actually occur. The athlete can load, pause, gather tension, and then they can express all that force in that availability. Now, reactive strength is something that is different. It's the ability to rapidly absorb force and then immediately re-express it with minimal ground contact time. So think of the first ground contact after a sprinting step, for example. Think of that plant foot and a cut. Think of a basketball player tipping a rebound or immediately going back up for a second jump after they've maybe made one block attempt or one rebound, another rebound attempt. And the contact time of those actions is measured in hundredths of a second. There's no time to load and settle, regather yourself. The whole event is a reflexive neuromuscular response, obviously in the context of sport and athletics. And here's why this is important from a practicality standpoint. So from a research side, a 2010 review by Markoff and Mikulic in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, they synthesized the mechanisms behind the plyometric adaptation and found that neuromuscular coordination, not simply muscle hypertrophy or raw force production, was the primary driver of performance gains in plyometric training. So specifically, they highlighted that the enhancement of the stretch reflex and improvements in inter and intramuscular coordination were central outcomes. So to make this very, very basic for you to understand, the adaptation is the nervous system's ability to turn around force, not just having bigger muscles, okay? Big idea there is to get out from the nervous system's ability to do things. This is important because a lot of coaches program plyometrics like they're trying to build explosive strength. And I've been guilty of this in the past myself. Lots of volume, maximal intent, heavy counter movement, long ground contacts, and the nervous system adaptations that they're actually looking for are requiring something different. They require short, stiff, rapid contacts. They require the body to learn to operate as a spring, not necessarily a piston, something that you're probably going to hear quite a bit. You've probably heard in the past. And this is an analogy that I personally like. So let's break it down and what I kind of mean by this spring and piston effect. So the piston produces force by traveling through a range of motion, right? It compresses, it extends, it compresses, it extends back and forth. A spring stores and returns elastic energy almost instantaneously without significant range of motion change. Sport-specific plyometric quality is spring-like in more cases than not. It's about stiffness, the rate of force development, and the elastic energy return that you can get from all that. Not range of motion, not time under tension that you tend to think about when you think about hypertrophy training. So when you're programming plyometrics with excessive ground contact time, the focus purely on height or distance, you are training the pistons. And there's nothing wrong with that. They have their place. I want to be very clear about that. But when you want springs, you have to program for the springs. So you got to make sure you're understanding what you're training with some of these plyometrics that you might be implementing and whether you're trying to get more piston or you're trying to get more springs. All right. Now, almost every person that I know has kind of probably heard of this. And that's a stretch shortening cycle. Most can give you like a two sentence version or a very rough estimate of what they believe it is. And it's really muscles pre-stretch under load and then contract rapidly and they storing and releasing that elastic energy. And that's not wrong, but it's an incomplete picture, I guess is probably the best way to put it. And the incomplete version produces incomplete programming ideas. And so let's break this down to what the stretch shortening cycle really is. So stretch shortening cycle, I may also call it SSC here to simplify it. Here are my notes. It's going to have three distinct phases. So understanding each phase is going to tell you what to train, when you can cue it, and what a breakdown looks like in your athletes when you're implementing it or trying to improve the stretch shortening cycle. And this is something I think most people understand, but you know, I'll try to break it down into simple terms as well. And the first phase is going to be the eccentric phase, so the loading or the deceleration phase. And this is when the muscle tendon unit lengthens underneath load. Ground contact and landing, the dip before a jump, ankle dorsiflexion at initial contact and a sprint cycle. During this phase, the muscle is actively producing force while lengthening, what we call eccentric contraction. And the elastic energy is being stored in the tendinous structure, so mainly your tendons, primarily like the Achilles tendon and the patellar tendons for the most part on the lower body side when we think about athletics. And the quality of this phase matters tremendously to be able to set things up from the stress shortening cycle side of things. So if an athlete collapses into their eccentric, if there's excessive joint flexion, slow deceleration, or a lack of stiffness, two bad things are going to happen. So first and foremost is a lot of that stored elasticity is dissipated as heat instead of being returned. And that can be a big problem for many athletes. Being able to store that elastic energy is then going to be able to let you reuse it. If you lose it before you even can store it, you're not going to be able to express some of the athletic things that you're trying to do. And then second, the transition to the next phase is too slow to utilize a stretch reflex efficiently. So an athlete whose ankle folds on every ground contact is leaking energy every single stride they have to be taking. Again, for most people, you usually we're going to see issues with the transition phase, but there are people that are going to have the lack of the elastic energy from just collapsing, say, for example, doing too high of a depth drop, for example. All right. Phase two is then the amortization phase, and is the one that I think a lot of coaches commonly skip when it comes to their teaching aspect of trying to improve their athletics and the stretch shortening cycle and their plyometrics. The amortization phase is the transition, the brief moment between the end of the eccentric loading and the start of the concentric propulsion. It is the reversal aspect of the movement. And here's what is important to understand about the amortization phase. It's the shorter the phase is, the more effective that the stress shortening cycle becomes. So longer amortization means more elastic energy is going to dissipate as heat. This is why contact time is such a crucial variable when we're talking about all these things plyometric. When a coach or an athlete is cued to stick a landing, absorb it, and then drive up, they've just lengthened the amortization phase and then dramatically reduced the stretch shortening cycle efficiency. That's not ideally what would have happened. That cue is appropriate in a deceleration or a landing quality context. So if your athletes have a hard time putting on the brakes or landing effectively, then this can be very important. But if they can already do those things, then we do not want to do that in most cases than not. And it's the wrong cue if your goal is going to be, again, the plyometric power transfer into other athletic-based movements. Now, Turner and Jeffries, in a 2010 paper on stretch shortening cycle training applications, specifically note that the amortization phase duration is the most critical and most trainable element of the stretch shortening cycle function. The ability to minimize this transition time is what distinguishes elite reactive athletes from average ones, and it is directly trainable through appropriate plyometric programming. So something to keep in mind there, you will probably hear a lot about the amortization phase if you get anywhere near the stretch shortening cycle, even plyometric training in general. And it is important, and as they mentioned, it is very trainable. And the more you can train that, the more you can make those athletes look more twitchy. All right. Phase three then is then going to leave us with the concentric phase or the propulsion, the actual movement that you're probably seeing. And the muscle tendon unit shortens, forces applied to the ground, and then the athlete is going to move through space. This is the part that every coach happens to physically see, the jump, the push, the acceleration aspect, right? And the quality of the concentric phase is largely determined by what happened in the first two phases of the stretch shortening cycle, even though you're only seeing the third piece visually in most cases. If the loading was poor and the amortization was long, the concentric output is then submaximal, regardless of how hard the athlete is trying to push. So when you're coaching plyometrics and athletes' jumps look weak or their cuts look slow, the problem may not be a lack of the concentric effort, right? I don't think anybody's trying to be slow. They're trying to push as hard as they can. The problem is almost always upstream in this sequence of the stretch shortening cycle and how they load and how quickly they can reverse. And that is going to be your diagnostic piece when you go to look at them and break things down. You can usually cue and or be able to find some programming variables that are going to help improve that. Now, one more thing on the stretch shortening cycle here before I move on to the next thing is that the stretch shortening cycle is classified in two types based on duration. So you're going to have a slow stretch shortening cycle, which involves ground contact times greater than 250 milliseconds. This includes squat jumps, counter movement jumps with like a deep dip or a deep drop, deep hip bend basically is the best way for me to describe it here audibly if you're not watching over on YouTube, and depth drops with a deliberate settle as you go to land. A fast stress shortening cycle involves contact time under 250 milliseconds, often well underneath this. And this includes sprinting, bounding, your reactive hops, drop jumps with very minimal contact, trying to reverse that as quick as you can. And sports performance is dominated by fast stretch shortening cycle demands in most cases than not. So most plyometric programs are dominated by slow stretch shortening cycle exercises, unfortunately. And that is the transfer problem that we're having with a lot of plyometrics going into athletic endeavors. Now, this next section is something that we're going to break down, and that's going to be the RSI and the reactive strength index side of thing, and it's going to be your best way to monitor this if you have the ability to do so. And if you're not using the reactive strength index, if you have the ability to start using it, I think it's fantastic. I have experience of it with it at Purdue, and it's one of the most practical and informative and underutilized tools just overall in athletic performance, although sometimes the financial side of it is what holds people back from being able to use this. And it's not always practical, but if you have access to it, you certainly want to be able to use it. But the reactive strength index or RSI is just purely a ratio. And the formula is pretty simple. It's not anything overly complex. Your RSI equals jump height. So how high you get off the ground divided by the ground contact time. And so a higher RSI means the athlete is producing more height or distance in less contact time, which is exactly what sports are going to require. And that a lower RSI means that they're spending more time on the ground relative to their actual output, which then flags that a stretch shortening cycle efficiency problem is there. Now, Flanagan and Commons, writing in the Strength and Conditioning Journal 2008, made a compelling argument for RSI as both a training guide and a readiness monitoring tool. So they showed that RSI had a strong relationship with change of direction ability, more so than the vertical jump height or broad jump distance alone by themselves. The reason is intuitive once you understand what the stretch shortening cycle is doing. It's not just about how high or how far you can jump. It's about how quickly you can produce that output. In change of direction, acceleration, the first step quickness that we like to talk about in athletics and parents like to talk about, contact time is incredibly important. So how do we actually use the RSI numbers in a real coaching environment without access to a force plate? Because I know that's probably going to be like the number one question, right? And the simplest method is to drop jump protocol. So you're going to have your athlete drop from a standardized box height. The research says 30 to 40 centimeters for most athletes is what usually works well. And immediately jump for maximum height. You can estimate the contact time using a high frame rate video on any kind of smartphone that you happen to have, or use a contact mat if you happen to have one. The ratio gives you a benchmark you can track across the training block if you really wanted to. Now, what should you look for first when you're tracking your RSI? Now, first, track the changes over time over a mesocycle, right? As plyometric training produces adaptations, RSI should trend upward. So if plateaus or drops, you may have accumulation of fatigue, or you may need to adjust your programming stimulus. Second, use RSI to guide exercise selection. So I think this is incredibly important. It's one of those valuable things that you can get from it when you use it. An athlete with a low RSI relative to their jump height has a contact time problem. They need more fast stretch shortening cycle work, more stiffness in their training, more ankle and tendon emphasis, right? We need to look less at muscles and more at the structures. An athlete with relatively short contact time but low jump height has a force production issue. They may need more strength or slower stretch shortening cycle-based work as their foundation. Now, I'm going to make a very blanket statement here, but generally speaking, the younger they are and or the younger training age that somebody has, you can usually assume that they're going to need more of the force production, right? It's very, very simple. They just do not have the ability to create enough strength and enough force to be able to propel their body through space. Once they reach like a threshold of having enough general strength, for many athletes, it's then going to be about chasing that fast stretch short cycling work, right? Doing everything you can to improve their stiffness and improve that tendinous adaptation. Again, not always, but for a good rule of thumb, especially if you don't have a way to be able to figure out all this stuff, then I do think that's incredibly important. Now, a third and often overlooked application of RSI is the readiness monitoring, which I kind of talked about here earlier. But contact time increases when an athlete is fatigued, undertrained, or recovering from soreness. So if you do a brief monitoring drop jump protocol, as we mentioned, with if you don't have the mats, 5 to 10 jumps, track the contact time and height, and you get an objective readiness indicator that is more sensitive than most wellness questionnaires. Now, most people are using wellness questionnaires, but the key thing I want you to understand here is that if the athlete's RSI drops 10 to 15% below their individual baseline without any other kind of explanation, that's a flag to manage their load for the day. Now, this can be done through other things. I'm not saying you have to do this. You can go, this used to be old school of just measuring people's vertical jumps or, drop jumps and being able to measure that. I've definitely heard of that and seen it done as well. Most people are using mats and other things to be able to monitor this stuff. So I think it's a little less important now, but it is something that is applicable and can be done if you really wanted it to. All right. Let's talk about mistakes, and not to throw anybody under the bus here, because I've made most of these mistakes myself at some point in my career as well. So, I'm just as guilty as potentially anybody else. But because identifying the error pattern is how you make the correction here in what you're doing, and correlate this into improved programming. That's ultimately what we're trying to do here, is just make training more efficient, make it better. I'm guilty of this. Many of these topics that I talk about on my podcast in general are mistakes that I've made or I've seen other coaches make more frequently. And the goal is to try to clean some of that up, right? So here are the five I've seen the most consistently in the industry, some of these myself included. Okay, mistake number one is treating plyometrics as a warm-up filler. And this is something that you will see constantly in the industry. 10 box jumps before the strength session just to get things going, a couple of hurdle hops to get the nervous system going. And the intention is fine. There is some benefit to, post-activation potentiation in this context. But calling it plyometric training is inaccurate, in my opinion. For a plyometric stimulus to drive meaningful neuromuscular adaptation, it needs to be programmed with the appropriate volume, intensity, recovery, and general progressive overload, just like any kind of strength conditioning work that you'd be doing. So just throwing plyometrics in as an afterthought doesn't meet that threshold. It's maintenance at the absolute best, and it's just noise at the worst. So I don't think, what I really want to be very clear here is, if you're doing it as a brief priming, just to get you going to do something else, I guess that's okay. As long as you understand that you're not using it to actually aid any kind of athletic performance in terms of being able to jump higher and run faster and jump further and change direction better, then if we're all agreeance on that, then that's fine. I'm completely okay with that. I give some plyometric work to some of my strength athletes as well to get them going. There's nothing wrong with that. The goal, though, is not to necessarily make them jump higher. It's to prime them, make them feel better for their squats, their deadlifts, their bench press, what have you. That's entirely fine. Just as long as we're on the same page there, we understand that. So just understand that you can't just throw 10 box jumps in before your sport practice and expect your athletes to start getting better. That's the big thing I want you to take away here from that mistake. All right, mistake number two is prioritizing height and distance over the quality of the execution of some of the exercises. Box jumps height has become a very big social media metric, and it's something I'm very big on, because how high you jump on your box jump height does not mean a damn thing to me. And it's a disaster from a programming logic as well, saying you should do X percent of your box jump height. I've seen coaches celebrate 50-inch box jumps on an athlete who buckles at the ankles, they collapse their knees, their butts between their ankles when they land. That's not good quality plyometric adaptation. It's basically a hip flexor test, a mobility test, a hip mobility test at best. They could be having some potential injuries happen from that, from either missing the box or landing in bad positions. The metric that matters is how you get there, not just the measurement at the peak of how high you can get your body to land on it. So the quality movement mechanics, the stiffness underneath the load, the contact time, these are your markers of plyometric quality, right? The landing mechanics, the actual distance that your feet move, how high you actually jump, how high box you land. Those are all the things that we're after here. So don't just use the height of something to merely track the progress, in particular box jumps, if I'm going to go after one really bad exercise that gets done improperly, is going to be the box jump. All right, mistake number three is in chronic underdosing and overdosing simultaneously. And this one sounds somewhat contradictory, but let me explain it so we understand here. That a lot of coaches program too few plyometric sessions, say once a week with low volume, not a whole lot of progression, to drive some kind of meaningful adaptation. And the research on plyometric training volume for Milan and Mastalija in 2009 suggests that even short in-season plyometric blocks, when programmed consistently at adequate doses, produce significant improvements in sprint time, their jump height, and change of direction ability in youth athletes. So the stimulus needs to be consistent. And at the same time, many coaches overdose within the individual sessions. So they provide massive amounts of volumes of high intensity jumps with no periodization in mind, which then is going to drive fatigue, which then blunts the nervous system, and then it increases your injury risk, may even burn them out for their actual sport practice or their athletic endeavors that they're doing. And the solution is a periodized approach with clearly defined intensity and volume parameters that will progress over time with the athlete. So the big thing that I'm trying to get you to take away here is that maybe they're like about one day a week, and so they take all this volume of plyometrics and throw it into one, or they just do a little bit of plyometrics, that's it, that one day a week, and they're underdosing it as well. ideally what's going to happen from a plyometric standpoint is ideally they're going to get it 2 to 3 times per week, and you're dosing on different things, you're focusing on different movement patterns, you have different emphasis days, and you're still getting enough intensity and volume in each individual session that you can build on that over the course of the training block, not getting stupid high doses. And this is a big issue, especially at the high school level, is just doing a plyometric day. Okay, you don't need a plyometric day. If you have your plyometrics programmed efficiently, you can do them several times per week. And again, talk about priming things for your some of your main strength movements as well, but you can have those correlate with other lifts that you're doing as well. So there's other ways to go about this. The key thing here is to make sure, again, that you're not underdosing the frequency, you're not overdosing the volume, especially combined together. Now, mistake number 4 is going to be zero specificity. And I think this is an important one. Okay. I want to be very clear, though, that I understand that all training is general physical preparation for sport. However, some sports do rotate. Some sports are single leg dominant. Some sports are both leg dominant. Some, you know, are going to use multiple change of direction. They're going to use different energy systems. Some are going to be repeated power outputs. Some are going to just be one big burst, one big throw, like a shot put, for example. Okay. So a box jump is clearly bilateral. It's vertical. It's slow stress shortening cycle movement. It's all broken down. If your athlete is a soccer midfielder, for example, whose entire game is for the most part unilateral, horizontal, reactive, they're sprinting, they're planting, they're cutting, they're changing direction, right? All in very short periods of time, then box jumps are so far from their sport demand that the transfer is minimal. Okay, it's not going to be zero, but it's going to be minimal. General plyometrics have value as a training base. So going back to this general preparation, I do think that's important. But if your general movements are all yours that you're going to program, then you've built a foundation and you've never actually built the house on the foundation over time. So you need to progress towards specificity. And we'll talk about how to do that later here in the episode. And I program general stuff too, especially for the very young youth athletes, because we have to, you know, start with the base initially. If we do not know how to jump properly, how to land properly, how to work on these mechanics and slowly build up their intensity of their plyometrics, that's one thing. But if you've got a high school athlete that's trying to go play in college and you're just going to start with a regular box jump, you might need to get a little more specific and start implementing some hurdles or some depth drops and some change in direction work. That's going to have to be in there. They probably have the maturity to do it. So context is key here, but just understand that there does have to be some specificity at some point when it comes to some of these athletes, especially if you're trying to get the biggest return on investment and you've only got so much time. Now, mistake number 5 is going to be ignoring the strength prerequisites. Now, I'm also going to be very clear here that I don't think you have to squat X amount or bench press X amount or do X amount to be able to implement plyometrics, but I do think there's obviously a base level of strength that helps aid what you can get from plyometrics. Now, Schomel, Nymphis, and Stone published a thorough review in 2016 on the importance of muscular strength in athletic performance, and one of their central points is that strength is the engine for power expression. So an athlete who lacks basic force production capacity doesn't have the structural foundation to handle plyometric loads safely or to express the adaptations that plyometrics are supposed to develop. Now, another one, Lloyd and colleagues in their 2012 work on long-term athletic development were explicit that plyometric training should follow a foundation of strength training, not precede it. If you're programming high-intensity plyometrics with athletes who can't demonstrate basic movement quality and adequate strength baselines, you're building a house on sand. And this is really what I'm trying to get you to take away here is that, again, I don't think there's a certain number that you have to hit, but for most people, I think you could probably look at an athlete and say, hey, they lack a base level of strength, right? If I got a high school athlete that's only front squatting 60, 70 pounds, and they're a sophomore, junior, senior, yes, we're still going to do some plyometrics, but we need to get that squat up, right? If we want to be able to produce a lot of force, we've got to get the squat up, right? We've got to be able to front squat well over 100 pounds for a female, for example, for repetitions, and a guy well over 135, in my opinion, to really be able to do something here, right? If those numbers are that low, we've got bigger issues to address. So the key thing I want you to understand here is that many people, especially look on social media, will try to do all this fancy stuff with the plyometric stuff, and really they just need some general strength to be able to express their plyometric training and get the most out of it to begin with. So now that we've established what's wrong with most programs, let me give you some practical ideas here for building one that's going to work for you. And you can call it like, you call it almost like a specificity spectrum, I guess. You know, it's always somewhere on the spectrum of where it's going to be the most specific towards what you need. And the concept is very simple, even though the application is going to require some judgment on our end. So just think about your overall spectrum and what those look like when you think about, say, like a rainbow or the black and white scale. So on this spectrum, for example, on the far left, you're going to have your general plyometric training. So bilateral, vertical, slow stretch, shortening cycle, minimal support relationship. We're going back to that box jump. So your box jumps, your squat jumps, your broad jumps, your different type of upper body arm swings, things like that. Going more lower body here, but just follow me. These have training value as, again, a foundation, particularly in developing basic neuromuscular patterns and building tolerance for impact loads. They have a place. And then on the far right over here, you're going to have your sport-specific reactive-based training, so unilateral or bilateral, depending upon the sport, obviously. The sport plane dominant, so whether it's transverse or frontal plane dominant sport, fast stretch shortening cycle, context driven. So a basketball player doing continuous single leg reactive ankle hops, transitioning into a vertical jump out of that, or a soccer player performing lateral bounding exercises with a reactive plant and drive on each one, or we like to call it two-way lateral bound. A sprinter doing wicket runs and different kind of wicket hops are all going to be something that's a much more specific. And our job as a coach is to move athletes from the left on the spectrum to the right on that spectrum as their training age and cycles progress towards the competitive seasons. So early off season, left side of the spectrum is completely fine, in my opinion. Give them a break, work on some of the basics, clean some stuff up. Totally makes sense, right? High quality general foundation to get things going. Late off season, you can be in the middle and the towards the right side of that. Here, so increasing specificity, increasing that stretch shortening cycle speed that you're getting from the exercise you're choosing, increasing the context relevance, making it look a little bit more like what they're going to actually do in sport. And then in season, you're going to be on the right side. You're going to make sure you reduce your volume. You're going to have high quality efforts, and you're just going to maintain the adaptations that can transfer to that sport, hopefully the best with your best guess, and just looking at the sport demands and then making decisions from that. Now, let me break down the exercise categories that will be with your plan. See on the spectrum here. And so the first one, again, going back to where we started, is going to be that bilateral vertical. So squat jumps, counter movement jumps, box jumps, depth jumps. These are your general foundation. You have high intensity, manageable technique complexity, So most people should be able to pick these up with a few coaching cues, get the hang of them. It's good for developing just the raw power output and basic stretch shortening cycle awareness. It's appropriate really at any phase, but it's very dominant in the early phases and for the very young athletes and beginners. Category two is then going to be your bilateral horizontal. So now we start to talk about broad jumps and different bounding variations. Horizontal depth drops, these start to include a horizontal force vector, which is more sport relevant for most field and court athletes who are having to move forward in space. They're still bilateral. They're still relatively accessible from a technicality standpoint, but they're more about like the middle of your training year. I personally like to still introduce kids into broad jumps as well, but I kick up the complexity of them a lot as they get more advanced or closer towards their seasons if they are already more advanced. Now, category three is then going to be unilateral options here. So your single leg box jumps, your single leg bounding, your single leg reactive based hopping drills. Most sport movements are executed on a single leg. So when you look at majority of sports, a lot of the power and athletic based movements are going to come from a single leg perspective or involve a single leg force application into another object, for example. This is where specificity starts to actually increase a little bit when you look at this. And these are require more structural capacity from the knee, the ankle, the hip, the trunk to be able to stabilize things. This is why you don't lead with a single leg plyometric. Almost more cases than not, you do not do this with athletes unless if you get somebody that's a very high advanced level athlete and you have a short period amount of time, and this isn't going to be new to them. But for most athletes, this should never be the first step. You should almost always go bilateral to unilateral. And then category four is then going to be the reactive and multi-directional piece. So hurdle hops with lateral transitions and landings, bounding with different changes in direction, mixing up some kind of variability, maybe even have to react to something. Multi-planar based movements are going to be here where they're either twisting or rotating and jumping in different planes and areas, different reactive single leg landings, and being able to be shifty into those exercises, even partner reaction based drills, right? These are going to sit on the very far right side of that spectrum that we've talked about. They're going to have high stretch shortening cycle speeds. Direction is going to be uncertain for some of them. The landing is going to be uncertain for some of them. You're going to have minimal setup, maximum sport transfer in terms of the variability that you're going to be able to apply there. These belong in terms of the final preparatory aspect and block of your in-season side or your maintenance. Try to be able to do that, as again, so long as the athlete is ready for them and advanced enough. And I do believe these are going to be three good general rules that I like to think of when it comes to me programming plyometrics. And I think if you do this, it will help you along the spectrum. The first one is going to be always earn the next step. Okay. You earn your right to move up the spectrum. And I do this for strength training. I do it for plyometrics. I do it for my mobility, conditioning, right? You have to earn your ability to progress in anything in this context. And plyometrics is no different. So make sure you understand that. Getting basic mechanics and bilateral and vertical-based movements first before you start to add unilateral-based things. You know, demonstrating stiffness and contact time quality before you add reactive uncertainty to certain athletes. Make sure that they can demonstrate they can do that and do it well. Second thing I like is don't abandon the earlier categories, okay? Reduce their volume and keep them as quality maintenance. There's nothing wrong with an advanced athlete doing a seated box jump. I do seated box jumps. I've been training for a long period amount of time. There's nothing wrong with some of the basics. You can use them in certain contexts. So you don't have to completely abandon some of these. It may even be what the athlete needs to work on certain aspects for their sport. So again, context is always going to be key. You don't have to abandon something that looks beginnerish for an advanced athlete. And then third, the timeline of moving across the spectrum of how the, you know, exercises look, again, more basic, bilateral, vertical, should track with your periodization model, okay? This isn't going to be like an eight-week linear program that you jump on and breeze through the spectrum to go from that jump to the more reactive thing. It's a conceptual tool and a layer of something that you put into your training up upstairs in your head, whatever your programming that you're already using. Your natural progression models, you know when season is, when out of season is, and you can ebb and flow across that as long as you've got, again, an advanced athlete. If you work with some of the beginners like I do, they're going to live in the middle to left side of that spectrum. More cases than not, we'll dose in some stuff to have some fun, challenge them a little bit, but they're not going to be doing these fancy drills that you happen to see on social media. We're working on the basics with these young kids, and we're trying to get the basics right, but we do have to give them some uncertainty and some variability into their training as well so they get used to adapting to it. All right, let's move into this for the last sections here. I want to give you a template for periodizing plyometrics from a standard off-season training block. And you know, we can say this would be a 6 weeks off season, for example, is what I basically drew up into a preseason because it's a realistic window that I think most people will probably get if you're getting clients and working with athletes. And you'll need to modify timing, obviously, for different sports, but you'll get the idea. So the first 4 weeks here is going to be just your general foundation, right? The goal here is to build structural tolerance and establish baseline strength, establish a baseline stretch shortening cycle mechanics. So your volume is going to be relatively moderate, 80 to 100, maybe 120 ground contacts on the high end for any given workout. The intensity is going to be low to moderate. You're generally going to do bilateral vertical based work, slow stretch shortening work. So don't implement this aspect with jump jumps, no high speed bounding. The work in this block is just counter movement jumps, box jumps to landing with like a good quality landing mechanics, broad jumps for some distance and some technique work, and introductory ankle stiffness drills. Two sessions per week usually works great on this. You know, obviously giving you ample rest between those sessions. If you can get 48 to 72 hours, that'd be ideal between the sessions, and that's going to allow your nervous system to recover. And then the strength training should be concurrent with that, and then built in with however you like to do your strength training. I'm not going to go into that on this. And then the plyometrics are really kind of the secondary stimulus, if you will. They're still important. You still do them at the front end. Yeah, that doesn't change. but maybe just general strength is what you're after here, and you're dosing in some of the plyometrics at some of the baseline levels, as we talked about, and the things I talked about here. Your then next four-week training block is going to be more of the developmental side. So your volume is going to start to increase a little bit because you built a baseline, so you can justify going 100, even up to 150 ground contacts into a given session if you needed to. Intensity moves more towards that moderate, the higher end. And then your stress shortening cycle speed is going to start increasing. So you're going to start to introduce some depth drops and basic depth jumps at the end of the training block, or maybe at the beginning, you know, end of the training block, and you're starting to build those up. And then you add in some unilateral work as well. Again, very small doses here, single leg bounding, some single leg box jumps. And that can be a good thing there to get some introductory pieces for what's going to come to the block later. And then you can also introduce those horizontal plyometrics at a meaningful volume. So your broad jumps or whatever, you can start to really push the volume. That's the majority of the volume is going to come is moving them forward in space, and then introduce some of those single leg things as well. Now, a 2004 study by Chimera and Al, they found significant neuromuscular adaptations in female collegiate athletes after just 6 weeks of 2 times a week of plyometric training, with measurable improvements in muscle activation patterns and stress shortening cycle function. So in 6 weeks, with consistent and appropriate dose training, you can actually see some really good quality progress from your plyometric work if you're doing it properly and you're dosing it, you know, appropriately. So I threw that in there just to show you that, you know, after basically a month and a half to 2 months, you should be able to start to see some progress in your athletes if you're picking the right stuff and you're laying these out appropriately. And then the next block here, so your third block, is going to be more of your specificity block. And this is where you're going to actually look at the sport, get some context, get an idea of what the athlete's really going to need. Your volume is going to drop a little bit, so you're going to be more back down to that 80 to 100, maybe 120 foot contacts in each individual session. But intensity and specificity are going to be much higher towards that actual sport that they are doing. So you're doing more reactive, multi-directional based work if appropriate. You might have some partner drills involved, again, if appropriate. You're going to have some reactive plant and reactive based work in that case. Again, I really love reactive lateral bounds here for these. Continuous single leg hopping, transitioning into sprinting variations. So you're going to mix in some different sprinting options to be able to get them to react and then be able to go hard really quick. And then again, lateral bounding with other change in directions in terms of their speed and agility portion of it. The movements are going to look more like a sport. That's the best way I can say it. The stress shortening cycle speed should be very high in terms of the reactive side. And the strength training, that volume needs to decrease during this training block or when you start to increase the specificity because of the plyometric intensity demands. So your athletes need their nervous system to be able to recover from everything you're doing. So you can keep the strength training side, the volume down here. This is what I usually do is I drop the volume on the accessory work and even the main work. You know, the reps are going to go down, the sets are going to go down, the accessory work. And we really just try to keep the intensity higher on the main work that we're doing and make sure that the volume of work stays on the lower end. And then that's going to keep them being able to perform at their best, not only on the field, but also in to get to their plyometric speed and power work that we're doing as well. It's not going to be a block that you're trying to maximize everything all in one go. And then you can have a peaking and transition block the last couple of weeks if it's something that you know that you're going to be trying to target. So those are the last 2 or 3 weeks, give or take. And you can transition out of this, obviously, as well into your next offseason. So during the peaking, you definitely want the volume to be on the lower side, 50-ish ground contacts, maybe a little less, maybe a little more in that individual session. You want the highest intensity you can possibly get with good quality over the quantity. And this is where the athletes should look and feel their sharpest. If they don't, that's when you start to shut it down. 2 sessions per week is going to be really all you need to be able to make sure you maintain and continue to make progress here in these last couple of weeks. And they should be brief, quick, get in, get out kind of sessions as well. And then it's going to transition you into your in-season maintenance model again, where you're just going to, again, keep the volume on the relatively low side, re-sustain adaptation with maybe 1, maybe 2 sessions a week. Again, keeping it, again, that 40 to 50 ground contacts, that's it. Focusing on the quality and minimal soreness that you can from the programming side. So it really just ebbs and flows, right? And just as any kind of training does. And as you get there, you just maintain what you can. If you can make, if you make some progress, it's awesome. The goal is to try to maintain it. Now, here are some different case studies that you can take away to hopefully maybe they'll make this stick. So let's start off with a sprinter here. The primary plyometric demand for a sprinter is obviously going to be horizontal force production application with extremely short ground contacts. Elite sprinters have contact times at top speeds of approximately 80 to 90 milliseconds. That's very fast stretch shortened cycling demand on a scale that's almost incomprehensible when you're thinking about how fast that is, 80 to 90 milliseconds. So your training will perfectly replicate that, but we're going to build towards it as close as we possibly can. So for sprinter, the specificity spectrum would move aggressively towards horizontal propulsion, moving them forward as much as we can, and fast stretch shortening cycle based work. So wickets are great for this, continuous long-legged bounding variations moving forward, reactive ankle hop things and pogos, A-skips to sprint transitions, and resistant plyometric bounding are all on the right side that we would really going to try to drift towards to get them for. Vertical bilateral jumps are their foundation, not specific. So again, going back to regular box jump stuff, it's very basic stuff. So program those more early and then taper them and then replace with the horizontal base stuff as you go. You're going to progress towards that for that particular athlete. So those are the things I like to do with my sprinters. I also really do a lot of weighted sprinting with the sled, and I will ebb and flow that depending upon what we need. I start them off very light, build up to build some hamstring tolerance, get them used to it, push them hard for about a block at a heavier load. It's still a sprint, but as heavy as I would possibly get it. And then when it comes to pulling off, then I decrease about 10% of the load that they were doing over the course of the next 4-week block. And that's going to let them feel the realization of all that sprints. And then we just try to maintain that light to moderate in season. So they're still dragging a sled really hard and fast, but I just make sure that our volume and our yardage is down because I know they're probably sprinting in practice, right? All right. Case study number two is going to be a soccer player. And we're going to say that from what I can find anyways, they make an average of 50 to 70 explosive efforts per game. So it just means like all out efforts. So sprints, accelerations, deceleration, hard directional changes. It's impossible to count how many they have, but in terms of hard efforts, 100% efforts, that's what I kind of found doing some Googling. And most of those are obviously going to be unilateral, and most of them are going to be in the horizontal and lateral planes. And almost none of them are going to be anticipated in advance, right? They're reacting to a stimulus, the ball and or the defender. And so the key stress shortening cycle demands here are going to be fast, reactive, and multidirectional. So specific plyometric work for these athletes should emphasize lateral bounding for sure, reactive single leg planting and driving, again, going to a reactive lateral bounding, bounding off of boxes or doing banded work here, random direction of reactive hops, either off voices or visual cues, so you can have them sprint and shuffle with those cues, and sprinting cutting drills where the cue is, again, just going to be randomized. So having them sprint, backpedal, change directions, all those on different cueing variations. And then from a general foundation side, the sport demands are going to react to the lateral forces. So your late block and end season work should look like those. And then your more basic stuff, again, can go back to just regular box jumps, regular hurdle hops, and doing some lateral based work with both legs. Those are all going to be fantastic. But it gives you an idea of how those are going to look a little bit different than, say, that sprinter that we had there on the first athlete. Now, the third athlete I want to talk about is, say, like a basketball player. In particular, more of the guards, you know, the little shifty guys rather than the big centers. But they are always going to, they're also going to need vertical reactive power on part of their athletic spectrum here. So they need to have the ability to jump off not only one, but both legs. Because you never know what's going to happen. They also have to make sure they can land on one leg and two legs effectively, and then immediately jump again to either react. That can be sideways, that can be vertically. They also need that lateral reactivity as they go to guard somebody, quick first step as they go to dribble, accelerate, decelerate, right? They really have a lot of different demands. So their stress shortened cycling demands are rather mixed. There's more vertical than your normal field athlete, but they're still going to require some fast amortization, also being able to change direction and be shifty. So specific work can include drop jumps to immediately vertical, single leg reactive verticals off of a lot of push, continuous line hops with acceleration-based work, defensive shuffling, learning how to work on shuffle mechanics and being able to push and plant hard, to being able to sprint reactively out of that, or even just do them you know, as a small drill itself. And I think the in-season maintenance for basketball players is critical, especially when we start talking about knee health. Basketball seasons are long. They're playing on those hardwood surfaces, and the accumulated fatigue that those basketball players can get is going to be very real. And so one quality plyometric session per week during the season, implementing stuff like this, can keep adaptation driving without necessarily driving a whole lot of fatigue. So basketball players, to me, I think are a different, unique. You know, I'll defer to Mike Robertson on the specificity and all the things basketball related. He's the guy to go on that stuff. But these are things that I've learned from Mike Robertson, talking with him and what he does with his athletes. And it seems to be what works well for them. And we've implemented a lot of stuff with our basketball players, and it's done well for them. So you've got a mixed bag here where you've got to develop the vertical. You got to be able to maintain it, right? But you also got to be shifty. You got to be able to hip turn. You got to be able to sprint. You got to be able to shuffle. Definitely a lot of different movement patterns that many sports are not going to see, especially all just in one sport as a whole. So you got to make sure you cover those bases when you're doing some different plyometric stuff, things to consider what they need. And again, you can also look at your basketball player and say, what are they not as strong as? And you put a little bit more eggs in your basket of those and try to maintain the qualities maybe they're already good at. Maybe their vertical's already great, but they don't move side to side as well. So you focus on that a little bit more. All right. Now we're going to talk about change in direction just as a whole. And the Flanagan and Commons research we cited earlier in the episode, they also established that RSI correlates more strongly with change in direction performance than jump height does. So that tells you something that's pretty important in my opinion, and that's that athletes who are good at changing direction are athletes with high reactive strength, not just powerful athletes alone. And the implication on the programming side is that change in direction training is, in part, plyometric training, okay? I cannot stress this enough, that working on change of direction is a piece of the puzzle when it comes to plyometric training. To think otherwise, its own little sector is not true. Plyometric training and the principles apply to your change of direction training. And in this case, speed agility, however you want to term that, right? So teaching athletes to land stiffly, reverse quickly out of cuts, and apply force into a new direction is stress shortening cycle training, and in sports is going to be huge for a lot of change direction sports, right? A lot of sports are made by how quickly you can change direction, get into and get out of a cut, plant your foot, and be reactive. And so plyometrics help with that, and therefore they are a form of plyometric training. And so you can unify your plyometric and your change in direction programming rather than treating them as separate entities. And I think when you learn to combine those together, then you're going to find that, wow, these actually have correspondence to each other, and they're helping each other, and they're helping the athlete at the end of the day. All right, before we end this episode really quick, I want to give you some practical coaching cues and things you might be able to take away here from a plyometric side, because I do believe there's some art to this as well. It doesn't get as much attention. Everybody goes over the X's and O's and how to program and what you should be implementing in your programming from a plyometric side. And so these are the most effective cues that I've found that help me with my athletes and interns and coaches and people that I talk to for the key points that we've got here today from the plyometric side. Yeah, for contact time and amortization, you can teach people that top floor, the floor is lava. That's one that a lot of younger kids really get. So you just tell them to imagine the ground is a hot surface and you need to get off it as quickly as possible. And so it's going to drive fast ground contact without a lengthy explanation. You can also say bounce. Don't land, being bouncy. Most kids understand what that means. And it's going to shift their mental thought process here from landing as a event that the thing is over versus to landing as a part of the processing to get off of there as quickly as you can. So they land with the anticipation that they're going to leave the ground again. Now, for the ankle stiffness, very basic one, just going to have stiff ankles as a coaching cue. It seems very obvious, but it is effective. You can also teach athletes to push the floor away. That's another one I like, or with the toes of their feet here. And it keeps the intent external, and it keeps it very action-focused on what they're trying to do. You could also tell them that they're loaded up like a spring, and it frames the leg as this elastic structure. They don't realize that, but again, it's going to be something that the athlete and sort of the younger kids can grasp and kind of understand. And then for your horizontal propulsive-based plyometrics here, pushing the ground away and back from you is another one. You know, you don't want to push down, push it back and away, and that will push you forward. I think it fixes a lot of issues with athletes trying to cover as much distance as possible and accelerating, especially on the bounding side, if you try to implement that into bounding. And then they default into pushing down when you don't do that, right? This is about moving us forward as far possible as we can with each one. And the sports, usually when you move forward, are going to demand pushing back. So the force application for horizontal stuff is incredibly important, especially when it comes to running fast. And for the reactive work, landing and going, or go, 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 as soon as they go to hit something, you want to emphasize the speed and the importance of it. It's going to resonantly reinforce that the continuous stress shortening cycle without overcoaching every single rep, right? You don't want to coach every single rep, just quick, quick, snap the fingers, clap. That usually gets kids understanding how to be reactive and be quick, and then let the repetition do the teaching as they get that feedback and begin to go to do that. So you'll understand that with the reactive side, if you stay on them on the speed side, they will begin to realize when they start to slow down. Now, before we start to wrap this up for final end of the episode here, here are some things that I think that you can ask yourself about the plyometric training that maybe they're implementing and might be able to help you kind of gut check and really realize some stuff here. And so the first question is that what percentage of your plyometric training volume when you program it is fast stress shortening cycling events versus the slow stress shortening cycle events? If the fast seems like it's under 40% of what you're programming for your athletes, assuming that they have a moderate baseline of training, then you probably have a specificity problem where you're not giving them enough of specific stuff towards their sport. If they're a beginner, then you can ignore this. Number two is if you're tracking contact time in any form. And if you're not, I think that's okay. But if you have the ability to track contact time, I definitely think you should do it. I don't have the ability to do that. I've thought about buying some different things, but you really don't have to, but just watch your athletes move. If it looks fast, then it's fast. If it looks slow, figure out a way to be able to address the drill to help them speed up. And if it is something you're having to work on mechanics, then that's, again, another sidebar. Work on the mechanics and then work on getting faster. Number three is where on that specificity spectrum, and then we talked about that earlier, do your exercises sit relative to the calendar year? Okay, I think that's important to understand is where you're at in the calendar year with your athletes. Are you doing that work that's going to be helping them in the preseason and in-season window? Does it look like it's going to aid into the sport? Or are you doing things that are too basic and too general that they maybe don't need to do right now? Number four, do your athletes have the strength prerequisite for the plyometric intensity that you're prescribing? Again, going back to having a baseline general strength. Again, I work with a lot of young athletes, so I've got to make sure I bring up their strength level as well. I can't just throw them into intense plyometrics. But again, I also see high school athletes where their general strength is just not there. We have to get their strength up to be able to give them more advanced plyometric exercises. We can't just give them something fancy just because. There has to be a reason behind it. So get your strength up if at all possible if they don't already have it. You know, adductor single leg strength is another big one that I don't see in high school athletes. They might have the bilateral side, but their single leg strength is not quite there, especially from a landing or change of direction side, especially when talking about hip strength. And then number five is going to be, is your in-season maintenance work that you're giving your athletes, is it going to be of quality and substance, or does it tend to just go away? Do you tend to back it off way too much? Keep the effort and the intensity high as you possibly can, and it will continue to carry over into their competitive and in-season. All right. So to wrap this all up here, what all did we cover? So first we started with the transfer problem aspect of the plyometrics, the gap between your gym plyometric exercises and actual sports performance. And I also kind of talked about that most of this gaps come with the confusion of explosive strength and reactive strength. We broke down here that they're not the same thing, and sport is going to need more reactive strength at the end of the day. Now, we also broke down the stretch shortening cycle into all three phases. I went kind of deep into the stretch shortening cycle side of things, and we called out the amortization phase as the most critical and the most trainable element that most coaches completely ignore on the most case when it comes to the stretch shortening cycle. We talked about contact time, the primary diagnostic variable, and we also introduced and talked about the reactive strength index as a practical tool if you're able to use it. If not, it's okay, but I think if you have access to it, you need to be using it. And we also identified 5 common programming mistakes that I happen to see plyometrics almost as like a filler and not taking them seriously enough. People prioritizing their height over their quality, especially when it comes to their box jumps. Poor dosing as a whole when it comes to programming, having zero specificity in terms to the athletic endeavors. So look at your sport demands, try to find things that are going to have a higher correspondence, if at all possible, especially if your athletes are more advanced, and ignoring the strength prerequisites. If your athletes are overall super weak, plyometrics aren't going to make them a better athlete if you don't get their strength up. And then we also provided some specificity spectrum, how I like to look at things. Again, that's how I look at all my training, but in terms of the plyometric side of how you can go about choosing your exercises as the seasonality begins to approach. And then I also provided you just a general 4-week periodization template that how I kind of look at plyometrics whenever I'm looking at athletes from 16 weeks-ish out in their sport, what's going on in my head when I'm writing training programs as well in that case. So if you happen to take any value out of today's episode, the best thing that you can do that helps me out is share it with another person, whether that be on Instagram, email, Facebook, wherever you like to share it. That all really helps me out. I really appreciate it. You can also leave a review over on like Apple Podcasts. You can leave a comment on YouTube. You can like, subscribe to the videos if you happen to watch it over there. And if you're on Spotify, you can share that over to wherever you like to, or just wherever you like to social media at. Anything like that always helps me out. I really appreciate it. And I will, as always, I will also have show notes at the bottom of the episode in the description where you happen to listen to the episode. If you want to gather some extra information here, it's all down there in the show notes as well. As always, thanks for tuning in for the Thirst More podcast, and I'll see you at the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.